Here we go again, Paul.
Here we go.
Just back from Wexford. Had a wonderful time there, I must say.
It was. It's a fantastic festival, isn't it?
It's brilliant. And this year, of course, was I thought, super good. Booked out almost every night. And then the European premiere of Silent Night was great. Met Kevin Putz there, the composer, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer. He even bought a few bottles of wine to bring home with him in his suitcase.
Excellent.
So he was a happy boy.
And why? Why can't we have that in Dublin?
Well, I was down at the fireworks, you see, which launches at about 7:15 on the opening night. And there's a few little speeches, you know, these sort of rote speeches where you sort of go, ho, home. So when will they light the fireworks?
Finish.
But the Minister for Arts, Heather Humphreys, was working through a fairly standard speech. And then at the end, she said, and I have one announcement to make. So I perked up my ears and said, I'm now happy to announce that the Wexford Opera House, from now on, from henceforth, will now be known as the National Opera House. So I immediately scurried up to High Street, Wexford, with my iPhone camera and took a photograph of the Wexford Opera House, fully expecting that by the end of the performance they'd have done a nice bit of stage management and would have changed the name to... But they haven't done that
yet. National.
But it will be there eventually, yeah.
Did she get that one more thing? That's so popular now with all the tech people. Steve Jobs, just one more thing. I'm changing it to the National Opera House. No?
You'll have to answer your own question. I've no idea.
The only thing we need to do now is check how long it takes to get from the centre of a capital city to your National Opera House. And then see, do we have, because therein lies, you know, like we have the widest bridge in Europe, you know, for O'Connell Street, the broadest, the highest, the tallest. I think we could have the longest journey from the capital city to the National Opera House.
Well, they're improving the road, so it might be.
Anyway, thank goodness we're here at the National Concert Hall, which is a good 15 to 20 minutes brisk walk from the centre of town.
Something like that.
Or 3 hours on a bad day if you scuttle into HMV and the back for the classical section.
From the GPO, is it?
Or the GPO.
Centre town? I suppose it is. Beethoven and Brahms, heavyweight.
This is a fantastic concert. Yeah. I mean, this is the real... This is meat.
Yeah.
There's no fat. It's all
meat and two
lean.
Veg.
No vegetable. This is just like hunks of raw meat brought in on steaming plates by scaldrons and galleons of slaves housing this stuff in. The meat of classical music. Beethoven, Brahms.
Yes, absolutely. So we're dining at the top table.
We are.
At the top. It's interesting to me, the Beethoven third piano concerto. I think it's almost unfairly overshadowed by the fifth, the Emperor, the one that everybody seems to know. And yet when you listen to this a few times, you realise this is a superb piece of work, absolutely superb. Composed around 1800 and premiered in Beethoven's usual chaotic fashion.
Yes, it is. It's stunning, isn't it? I just, you know, that's what actually I do love. The more I learn about the chaos of each of these things, the more I gain solace for my own life and generally life lived by all of us. You know, he is a genius. The work is fantastic. It finally comes through eventually. But believe you me and believe all of us, the disasters of trying to get these things staged, because it makes him very human, how to get this thing on. And of course, he's even the performance, the premiere, of course, not only was he fighting with, you know, something new, he was also fighting against everything else that was on in town that night.
And he was premiering his second symphony that night as well, I think, wasn't he? In the same concert?
He was, yes. The concert, as usual, he always loads them up. So you've got this being premiered and you've got the second symphony being premiered on the same night, along with a whole host of other activity and a whole host of other performances that evening in the one concert hall. But of course, what's really going on is you're performing these things in Vienna. You're up against a lot of competition, and Haydn's Creation was being performed that night by the first string players all across Vienna. So if he wanted to drag the audience to his one, he's going to have to... Can you imagine? Beethoven, what'll I do to drag the audience? He has to have... Well, we'll put on the... You know, we'll have the second symphony premiere. We'll have this concerto premiere. So it's, you know, it's really trying to overload the draw. Whereas tonight, I'd be satisfied just listening to this on its own.
Absolutely. And we have here tonight as well Ireland's very own Mr. Beethoven. I think John O'Connor could now be considered to be national treasure at this stage. I remember, Tomás, I mean, my parents were quite friendly with a man called Victor Mahler. She was the principal horn player in the symphony orchestra back in the 70s. His daughter is now the principal harpist, Andrea. But I clearly, and there was a bit of music talk in our house, I clearly remember when John won the Beethoven competition in Vienna in 1973. This was a fantastic piece of news, not just in the cloistered classical world, but if you think, what was going on at the time? Well, Ireland was just sort of the new kid on the block in the EU. The news, though, coming out of Ireland was ghastly. Bloody Sunday had happened the year before. So here was a bit of, hey, we can do other things too, and it was happening on a world stage. You mentioned there about Beethoven there in Vienna. Obviously, Vienna is obviously, if the classical world, music world has a capital, it is Vienna. So here was John O'Connor. He hadn't won a competition in the back end of nowhere, in a place that no one had heard of. He'd won it in Beethoven's own backyard. And since then, he's achieved many other things. He was director of the Royal Irish Academy of Music. He set up the Dublin International Piano Competition, which is now very well established on the world stage. That may well be his greatest legacy. But if you think of John O'Connor, that, you know, the defining stamp there is Beethoven. He even has said, you know, Beethoven made me. That the core repertoire that he always plays is Beethoven. There a few years ago in the concert hall, he did a series of, I think it was 8 concerts, working his way all through the entire 32 sonatas. So if anyone knows tonight's piece, yeah, he does. And I was trying to confirm with him. There's this story I thought was apocryphal about the opening night, the premiere, where there was a young conductor, Pearl Seyfried was his name. He was the page turner for the night. And he was absolutely horrified that when the music was open, Beethoven, of course, was the soloist. There was almost nothing written on the thing. Some unintelligible, like Egyptian hieroglyphs, he referred to them afterwards. And I said to John, I said, is this true? He said, that has been verified, absolutely verified. And at dinner afterwards, apparently, Beethoven was having a great laugh at Seyfried's expense. Because typically what happens is the person turning the pages can obviously read music and see what's coming and reaches over, little nod from the performer, and you turn the page. No such thing happened on the night. He had to try and anticipate Beethoven, because all he had written for himself were a couple of prompts. It wasn't music at all.
Well, that's what I love about it. I mean, the whole thing to me, again, the humanity, the human nature of the genius that was Beethoven. But he's, you know, despite all this, he's sitting there and he feels he has to put up the paper. So he has the score up there, possibly turned away from the audience. And there's the page turner. He nods to him as he flips it over. Another blank page. But, you know, again, we used to have a fellow who used to say to us, if you've no props, you've no prop problems. And here was a prop problem to beat all prop problems. The man turning the page, there's nothing there. But he flips it over because the audience gains confidence that Beethoven is not just making it all up as he goes along. But of course, the genius of Beethoven is he is making it up as he all goes along. Because he sat down, you know, one day for every single work that we have with a blank script and then produced it out of nothing. But of course, we love the canonistic idea that even the genius composer is actually reading it from a text, you know, rather than coming out of his mind. But it wasn't the only sort of event of the day, because of course the actual performance itself, they did the usual for Beethoven, which is one rehearsal starting at dawn. Apparently it started about 7 or 8 a.m. in the morning, and they were pressing on through several hours worth of music being done in minutes, you know, in hour after hour. It's a disaster. It's falling apart. Every bit of it is having people attacking each other. There's shouting, there's moodiness, as befits a good romantic performance. But the only problem is that several people in the audience during the rehearsals, including the principal patron, Prince Karl Lichnowsky, I think, and he's there, and he's absolutely horrified by what he sees. And he realises that this thing is going off the rails badly. And, of course, the real problem, I think, for Beethoven, in fact, for many composers and for musicians in the 19th century, was there was no pizza. And pizza is the fundamental basis of a great rehearsal for many people in theatre, in music, in fact, in almost everything.
Send out for pizza.
In fact, the head of Amazon there last week said, you know, that in fact he has a 2-pizza rule. For the amount of people that can be in a room that are doing brainstorming, so that if you have to have more than two pizzas ordered, then it's not good for a tech sort of brainstorming. Now
they don't serve pizza here, do they?
I don't think they do. I don't think they do serve pizza here. But they can send out for it if the rehearsal's going particularly poorly. So what did he do? Well, he sent out for the Viennese 19th century equivalent, which was buttered bread, a selection of cold meats, and a lot of wine. And he noted that after the musicians had consumed a lot of wine, some healthily, heart-breakingly amounts, high amounts of meat and buttered bread, they restored their collegiate atmosphere and went ahead with zest for the rest of it. Oh, the collegiate atmosphere.
I love that. It was probably Grüneveltliner they were drinking.
It could have been Grüneveltliner, but, you know, I don't think it was. 3 days in Grüneveltliner, Wirvental country, has convinced me that that I think, in fact, it was probably bull's blood. Because remember, this is the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And sort of the Hungarian sort of hinterland is what would have really been supplying the hearty and lusty street wines of Vienna for obstreperous musicians.
But out of chaos, Moss, look at the beauty that has come, isn't
it?
Oh,
my goodness,
it's a beautiful piece of music. I'm repeating myself now, but it really is unduly overshadowed, I believe, by the Emperor Concerto. This is a magnificent piece of music. It starts, I mean, the first movement in itself is almost complete in itself. It has a symphonic feel to it and reaches this rousing conclusion, and then of course you go into this really soft contemplative it's marked largo, which is very slow and, you know, contemplative playing, beautiful stuff, and then rousing finish at the end again. Superb piece of music.
I mean, I absolutely overwhelmingly enjoyed it, but I'll tell you the real problem here is all you're doing is thinking, you know, about the oncoming sort of requiem. And while, you're listening to the first movement and you're thinking, this is rousing stuff, but of course, maybe even inappropriate. It almost feels sacrilegious to have this played before this enormous, you know, behemoth that's coming on towards us now.
You mentioned something there which I think is almost a key to the Brahms German Requiem. You said collegiality was restored amongst the musicians, and that's something which, if they don't have it in a piece like the German Requiem, with vast ranks of choir, soloists, instrumentalists, orchestra and so forth, then you've got nothing. I was talking to Michael Christie, who was the conductor of Silent Night there in Wexford. I said to him, have you ever conducted Brahms' German Requiem? Tell me all about it. And he was saying one of the things about it is that it's very important that there's a constant input from the conductor, because if that isn't there keeping it lively, there's a possibility that the thing can just sort of wander into monotony. Mm-hmm. So that has to be constant there, because there's a lot of the orchestral and choral parts here which I find beautiful, but they're sort of going along at a nice easy pace, and if you don't keep the thing, you know, with an electrical pulse there, you might say, then it can just, I think, get into slightly monotonous character. It's a magnificent piece. I absolutely love it. The second movement for me is the most stirring, you might say.
Yes.
And what I love about it is the human voice is extraordinary. If you think about it in terms of conveying emotion, what I love about, you know, instruments, they can convey emotion as well. But the human voice, I believe, conveys emotion in a way where it can flip from, you know, sorrow to joy almost instantly. I think it takes an instrument a little bit. There's a slower sort of pickup there, you might say. So you're getting this here all the time. You're being picked up and driven or carried along with this music. Wonderful music. And the great thing is, I say about it is, it's a requiem, but it's not too mournful or sorrowful. They say it's, he said himself, he could have called it a human requiem. So there's not the huge sort of, you know, mourning for the dead. It's almost, dare I say it, a celebration of life. There's an area, a sense of consolation, of resolution at the end of it, rather than you know, the sort of saying, oh my God, somebody's dead. Now obviously it was inspired by his mother's death, but I think it's almost a celebration of humanity more than anything else.
Ladies and gentlemen, our doors will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium. Our doors will close in 5 minutes. Thank you.
Or was it? Well, now, you see, I'm listening to you there, and as I'm listening, I'm thinking you're falling straight into all of the camps that have been traditionally put out for us. And the traditional camps for this, I mean, this is a centrepiece of classical music, sort of warfare. and it splits down the middle. Full-on warfare. And you've got, you're kind of espousing the kind of the Wagnerian, George Bernard Shaw, sort of Catholic dismissal of it in many ways as being a work of, high technical competence and excellent academic analysis, and a really wonderful evocation of Bach's, the fugue form when it comes on twice. We see this this happening, and the interplay and counterpunctual sort of elements within the actual singing itself. That all these are there, which are evoking these classical sort of elements, which of course is all aggressive dismissal of it as being sort of a cack-handed reversal back, sort of a homage to the past, and how terribly charming. But of course, what it's really about is that's the Catholic position on it, which is that what we're looking at here is essentially a Protestant a technical analysis of the fate of humanity, and it's somehow lacking the religious emotional element in it. And in fact, as you're well aware, at the launch, at the premiere, the part premiere, shall we say, in Bremen, we have the composer there inserting in a couple of elements into it to make sure that there's a religious note there. So he puts in, Handel, we put in Bach, several elements were put in to make sure that Jesus Christ the Redeemer makes an appearance during the evening, because it was in, they're looking at essentially a humanist examination. Now, he's using Luther's text, and it's full of sort of consolation, but it's all about humanity and the consolation of human loss. And there's a great deal of this the religious element has been exercised in some way, shape, or form. Now, that's what we see. Now, that's what we're told to see. I don't see much of that, largely because German is not my first language.
Okay, enlighten me tomorrow.
So what I'm hearing is, in fact, a fantastically emotional piece. That's what I'm looking forward to this evening. Second movement, definitely, probably the highlight for me as well. And I think what we're looking at is, it's not the histrionics of the Wagnerian, sort of concept of emotion. And maybe they were disappointed. They wanted that for something that had the word German Requiem on it.
So there was no beating of breasts.
No breast beating at all. It's a much more considered. In fact, I was listening to several sort of Philip Glass pieces, even Avril Pärt, the Requiem there. These are essentially, they, to me, are the legacy from Brahms, German Requiem. I suppose, the real point here is, of course, that he's probably not putting it in that mass form.
It's not the Requiem Mass.
No, it's not a Requiem Mass, so it's not following the traditional form that we expect, the Latin and the full form of what is essentially the musical soundtrack for an actual funeral. This is much more an oratorio. In the north, in that part of Germany, which is the solidly Protestant part, in Bremen, in Leipzig, in Hamburg, it gets uproarious uptake, and they see it immediately for what it is. They see the crystalline text, they see the crystalline form, and they know they've got to make their own way to understand what it is. So it's not lynched onto or hung on a mass which gives them the solid structure of how this thing is to be interpreted, and so that we know we get high emotion as we move our way through this mass, and we know when we're supposed to stand and sit. But we don't, not with this. And that's why, of course, it gets taken up hugely in England, and it gets taken up in particularly very early on by the Americans. And the Americans are playing lots of different sort of early versions of it, often, just sort of movement one, movement two. They're not playing the whole sort of period of it. But 1897, you've got the first full Chicago premiere of it, and it becomes a staple of the classical world in the US through this. I would suggest this lean and Protestant feel.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final call, ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. Thank you.